This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
When tech firms run the schools. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A number of Silicon Valley billionaires are putting up their own money to overhaul some of America's schools. Hear what the heads of Facebook, Netflix, and Salesforce are doing.
Autonomous cars of the future. Will they tunnel underground or take to the skies?
The awkward moment in multiplayer video games when you realize you're competing against a fifth grader.
And all that planning and money spent on the summer vacation. Well, did you consider travel insurance?
Well, travel insurance can protect your investment, your vacation investment. So it's a good idea to think about travel insurance if you're going somewhere. Now, not every trip needs to be insured, but there are some big ticket items like a cruise or a long tour, like say a couple of weeks in Europe. Or you might want to think about getting an insurance policy.
Consumer advocate Chris Elliott on when you might need travel insurance and when you don't. He's here later in the hour. Well, in the space of just a few years, technology giants have begun remaking the very nature of schooling on a massive scale, using some of the same techniques that have made their companies drivers of the American economy. Through their philanthropy, they are influencing the subjects that schools teach, the classroom tools that teachers choose, and fundamental approaches to learning. Fascinating story by New York Times reporter Natasha Singer. Natasha set this up.
Well, I'm a tech reporter in the New York Times business section, and I spent a year looking at Silicon Valley billionaires and their education projects in public schools. They include Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Reed Hastings of Netflix, and Mark Benioff, the chief of Salesforce. What was completely fascinating is that in the United States, you know, we have more than a century of this history of successful business titans working to change public schools. It dates back to like Carnegie and Rockefeller. But what's different today is that tech executives have expertise in creating rapid, large-scale change, right? They're scaling software to millions and billions of people, and they're using some of the same techniques that have made their companies linchpins of the American economy to create the same kind of rapid change in public schools.
Jeez. All right. So who's doing what, for example?
So Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, has a project with the San Francisco public schools, and he's basically adopted the entire public school system, and he wants to try to make it rival private schools with resources. So he's doing that through his nonprofit arm of his company called Salesforce.org. He's committed $100 million. He's doing things like they funded the development of a computer science curriculum for pre-K through senior high school students. They have put in technology. They've wired the schools or put in wireless internet access. But the most fascinating thing is that Mark Benioff started this thing he calls the Principals Innovation Fund. And he's giving $100,000 grants to every middle school principal to do whatever they want with. And, you know, you think of principals of schools as folks that don't have that kind of pocket change,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so that was a radical thing to do in the school district. In the beginning was like, you can't give our principals each $100,000 with no strings attached every year. Like, they might waste the money.
Yeah, yeah.
They might do things that, you know, give students whiplash. I mean, like, so the school district had to put in some parameters. Basically, you know, they have a kind of vision for what they want to do in the next 10 years, and they ask principals to kind of choose projects within that vision and also to submit budgets. But essentially, the principals are going around doing what they want. Some of them, you know, have put in robotics clubs or app development after-school clubs. One school had a high population of immigrant students and put in intensive English language tutoring for them. Mm-hmm. Other schools have changed their traditional libraries into kind of multimedia hangout zones for students. And some have, you know, done things that didn't work. And every year, the principals, the only requirement is they have to go once a year to meet with Mark Benioff themselves and tell him how they spent the money and what they wish they'd done differently and what they're going to do next year.
Jeez. All right, so I know you touched on a little bit. There are kind of few checks and balances here. Who's to say, I don't know, for example, the students are improving? Is there a way to measure?
So it's too soon to tell, and it is an experiment. And there's folks in the story who are in favor of this, and they say, look, these tech billionaires are experimenting with new forms to do good, and the federal government doesn't have the funds to do this, and we should let them do it. On the other hand, it's an experiment, and it's an experiment on 50 million plus K-12 students, and it might not benefit them. And, you know, we know that, again, we have 100 years of philanthropy in education in the U.S., of business leaders doing this, and a lot of their projects have failed. And so who is minding the store is the main question here.
Wow. We're speaking with Natasha Singer, reporter at the New York Times. Her piece is called The Silicon Valley Billionaires Remaking America's Schools. All right, so you talked about Benioff a little bit. How about Reed Hastings at Netflix?
So Reed Hastings also has a fascinating project. So you know that Netflix has this algorithmic personalization engine, and it's the thing that says, oh, you like this, maybe you'll like this other video, right? It analyzes all your data, and it suggests what you might watch next. So he got really interested in a math instruction startup that similarly used algorithms to personalize the math lessons students see. And this math startup was running out of money, so Reed Hastings stepped in, and he didn't buy the company. He donated money to a fund, a nonprofit fund, to buy the startup, but he saved it from going out of business. And now it's this math thing, it's called Dreambox Learning, is used by more than 2 million students in the U.S. And basically what it does is when a student answers a math problem, the system collects every piece of data about what the student's doing. They told me that the app collects 50,000 data points per student per hour. So not just if they make a mistake or if they get the correct answer, but if they hesitate or, like, if they answer quickly so that it looks like they're confident, or, you know, if they take them a long time. And so every time they answer a question, the algorithm decides what to show them next based on their past behavior. And so this is a new world. It's called adaptive learning technology because the system adapts to each student individually. And there is a lot of promise. There is not a lot of evidence yet that it actually benefits students' outcome. So in some school districts, they love this. A handful of parents I interviewed said, like, they have actually gone to the school and said, my kid is not doing this at home for homework.
Thanks, Natasha. Natasha Singer, New York Times reporter. Some story, right? 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Your laptop and that smartphone grafted to your hand are double agents. When you look at, or rather what you look at, where you go, and even what you say can be used to paint a portrait of you, leaving you as exposed as the day you were born. Much of Silicon Valley wants you to think the price of using the internet is letting them data mine your life. As Wall Street Journal tech writer Jeffrey Fowler puts it, you wouldn't walk naked through Times Square. Stop being naked online. He's put together a beginner's guide to fighting back. Jeff, what should we know?
Some of the biggest companies in the world, actually the biggest companies in the world, have made us think that using the internet, the cost of using the internet, is letting them data mine our lives. And it doesn't have to be that way entirely. There's things that anybody can do, even if you're not a super techie person, to protect your privacy and to keep snooping eyes out of your photos, your emails, the websites that you visit.
I thought the one line you had sort of the beginning of the story really hit home, like with a baseball bat. You said when the product is free, that means you are the product. Explain that.
Well, think about it this way. If something is free, that means they're probably just taking something from you that you can't see right now. And in the case of a lot of technology companies, it's data. And, in any given moment, a tiny piece of data about what page you're looking at or what page you just looked at or where your phone happens to be located at that moment might not seem like such a big deal. But what's happening is as the technology gets better and the ability of data mining and artificial intelligence to pull all these different sets of data together, companies are creating actually sometimes terrifyingly accurate profiles of your life, of you, everywhere you go. Google does this. Facebook is doing this. Everybody kind of wants to get in on this game. And the sort of the reason I wrote this column this week is to sort of show people that there are things, again, that you can do to stop at least some of this and fight back.
All right. So you say it could take an hour or so to kind of go through some of this, but explain some of what you put together, like the basics we could start working on today.
Yeah, definitely. Well, number one on the list is, you know, share less stuff. I mean, hey, Kim Kardashian learned this lesson, right? Remember when she got attacked in Paris?
Yeah.
That was because she was putting her location and her information online for the world to see. So aside from, you know, just sort of being more conscious of that kind of stuff, actually Facebook and Google have both made these sort of privacy checkup tools that are sort of hard to find, and I've got links to all this in my column to make it easier to find, but they take you through some of the basics. And the reason this is important is that the defaults on all these services are going to take more than you really need to give to them, both in terms of what you're sharing in public, what you're sharing with your friends, and what you're sharing with those companies, and they then allow advertisers to use to track you. So if you go through these privacy checkups, they will kind of help you decide better what you really want to be sharing with whom.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Jeffrey Fowler. His piece is called Don't Expose Yourself, A Guide to Online Privacy. One key point here, too, you said our smartphones don't have some of these privacy checkups. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, for all the talk that Apple gives about caring about privacy, they certainly have a lot of privacy settings and you know, knobs and twiddles you can adjust, but they don't have anything nearly as easy as those tools from Facebook and Google I just mentioned. But still, I think it's actually really important for folks to sort of, every once in a while, just take a census of your phone. So that starts with, like, do I have any apps on here that I don't really need or don't really use? If you do, delete them. Hey, you also will save space and maybe some battery life on your phone. But then you can go inside the privacy settings menu, which you probably never really bother looking at. If you go in there and you go under location, this is a really interesting one because it shows you all the apps that want to be able to track where you physically are whenever they want to. And some of them do it just when you're using the app, and that makes some sense. But others, they're asking actually to track your location so they keep a record of everywhere you go all the time. Some surprising ones that are on that list include the app Uber. Now, it makes sense that Uber might want to know where you are when you're taking a ride, but when you're not. So it's really worth your time just going to go through and decide, like, some of these things, they don't need to know this much about me.
It's Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Jeffrey Fowler. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Loans are made by WebBank. Funds are deposited for delivery next business day if approved by 4:30 p.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday. Amazon is not a part of this promotion. Rates and terms vary based on credit history. Other restrictions apply. See website for details.
Do you know that some Americans have more credit card debt than savings? Don't you wish that there was an easy way to consolidate debt and save? With a fixed interest rate loan through Avant, that wish can come true. Through Avant, you can bundle all those bills and simplify your debt into one monthly payment, saving you time and money. Over 500,000 customers have experienced the convenience of a personal loan through Avant. It's all online with no prepayment fees and no collateral required. And you can have $1 to $35,000 in as little as one business day. No wonder Avant has an A+ rating from the Better Business Bureau. And now Avant will also give you a $50 Amazon.com gift card after your first payment is made on time. To check your rates with no impact to your credit score and to get this special radio offer, go to Avant.com today and enter promo code 8080 when applying. That's AVANT.com, promo code 8080.
The airplane maker Airbus plans to start testing its autonomous flying car this year in Silicon Valley, which leads to the question, what will happen first? Autonomous flying vehicles for you and me, or a tunneling system like the one proposed by Elon Musk? Here's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group. Rob, how do you see this?
Well, so we've got two competing concepts. We've got Elon Musk, who, strangely enough, actually has a rocket ship company and certainly makes the Tesla cars, arguing that the future really is going to be digging underneath stuff and driving through long tunnels through cities. And then you've got folks like Airbus, the Google founders, and a whole bunch of other people, including, I think, Amazon's founder, Bezos, looking at things that fly, either to deliver people or deliver packages. And the end result is you've got this conflict. Musk doesn't think flying cars makes any sense whatsoever, and pretty much everybody else doesn't think that tunneling underneath cities is going to be, is going to be doable.
The digging, just as you point out, just seems expensive, tedious, and just fraught with risk. How come? Why? I'm surprised that he feels, you know, there's so much more space in the air, I guess, is my point.
Well, so the issue with flying cars is that it takes a lot of energy to do the lift. I mean, right now, they're unlike electric cars, where when you brake, you can recover some of the energy. We haven't figured out how to do that with drones yet. And the end result is it takes a ton of energy to lift something to height and then move it horizontally. It's okay for short delivery, but if you're actually going to move people around long distances, you've got that issue. And clearly, if you run out of power in an aircraft, especially one that's basically a flying helicopter, a flying drone, you come down pretty quick.
Yeah.
And there's that other issue. The arc probably could be about high, so using something like a parachute may not help much. Plus, those parachutes could get caught on buildings coming down. And then we have that whole issue with regard to weather. Many of the vehicles we're talking about flying probably have a top speed of around 65, 70 miles per hour. So you got a really stiff wind coming in. You're trying to fly against it. You're not moving that fast, and you've got that battery power to worry about again. So I get where he's coming from. That the problem with the vehicles is the fact you've got to lift them. It's a ton easier to implement though, because you have to dig the tunnels. The tunneling thing really to me only works if you're talking greenfield. In other words, if you can drop the tunnels in before you build a city, so say, for instance, if you wanted to build a city on Mars, then it makes a ton of sense, because then you drop the tunnels in first, you build the city on top, and you're all done. But trying to drop these tunnels in cities, I mean, can you imagine doing this in New York? I mean, New York has layer upon layer of old tunnels underneath the city that were built for other things, subways, old and aging plumbing, underground power. And a lot of those skyscrapers are embedded in bedrock, which means you can't go underneath them at all. So it makes it incredibly difficult and very risky.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's written a piece called "Will Future Autonomous Cars Fly Like Birds or Tunnel Like Moles?" Do you get the sense then that with flying vehicles, flying personal vehicles, we might pass right over autonomous cars at some point?
Well, you know, we've got the trials for autonomous flying vehicles and autonomous cars are going on at the same time. So we've got trials in Nevada and now Dubai on the flying vehicles. We've got trials starting in San Jose and flying vehicles with Airbus. So we've got at least three major trials going on in the world with flying vehicles. We've got more than that going on with autonomous cars, but as they say, they're going on at the same time. So it's not like we've got the cars in place and now we're starting off with vehicles. This is all happening in the same window. And from the standpoint of the autonomous part, flying is easier. It may not sound that way, but the thing is obstacles. In the air, there aren't that many. Yeah. On the ground, there are a ton of them.
Thanks, Rob. That's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. When to consider travel insurance for that upcoming summer vacation. Also, awkward moments among strangers in multiplayer video games, and where you can pay to change your wardrobe at schools with strict dress codes. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, on the health front, a look at something called FSHD, a muscular debilitating disease officially known as facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy. And it hits close to our radio home since our colleague Chris Carino is currently battling it. Chris is a radio broadcaster for the NFL through our parent company, Compass Media Networks. He's also the play-by-play guy for Brooklyn Nets basketball. Also heads up the Chris Carino Foundation, and he joins us now. Hey, Chris, good to talk to you. Explain, I guess, for the listeners, too, and me, what are the basics of FSHD?
Well, thanks, Gordon. It was most people have heard of muscular dystrophy. Very few have heard of facioscapulohumeral dystrophy, but it is a type of muscular dystrophy, and it affects mostly the facial muscles, where it's hard to make any sort of a smile or gestures with your face, and your scapula, your shoulder muscles, which make it difficult to raise your arms, and the humeral muscles, the upper limbs. It goes down to the back and the lower legs. It can make people, give them difficulty getting out of a chair or even walking. Many are in wheelchairs. So it's a progressive, debilitating muscle disease that changes people's lives, and it can affect you as it did with me in my early 20s, where you live your entire life thinking that, you know, you're a healthy, normal person physically.
Right.
And then at a crucial time in your life, you're now hit with this and you have to deal with this. And I'm trying to be an example for people that they can still achieve the things that they want in their life and also go out and try and raise money and awareness and try and get a treatment and a cure for this disease.
Right. So in your body, was it just dormant until your 20s?
It's a genetic disease, but it can turn up as a mutation. So while it wasn't in my family, others pass it down and know something about it. With me, it's just a deletion of a chromosome, and it's an overexpression of a gene called DUX4. And all of a sudden, in my teen years, it started to express itself. And the earlier in your life it expresses itself, the more severe case that you have.
Mm. How common or rare is this?
It affects roughly 20,000 people in the United States and less than 1 million people in the world. So when you have something that's that uncommon, it makes it difficult for people to get interested in and care for it.
Absolutely. So what are you dealing with right now at this stage of life?
You know, I'm a sportscaster. You mentioned all the work that I do, and I travel around the country, and it's a grueling schedule for even the most healthy people. So I rely on a lot of help, kindness of the people that I work with, kindness of strangers when I'm traveling. You know, just help putting that bag in the overhead compartment.
Mm.
Maybe putting a hand on a shoulder so that I can get up onto a curb. Someone helping lift me out of a chair. I mean, these are all things that people take for granted. But when you have FSHD, you don't take anything for granted. And, everything is a chore. But, I love the work that I do, so I'm determined to keep doing it as long as I can.
Man, speaking with our colleague Chris Carino, radio broadcaster for the NFL through our parent company, Compass Media Networks. He's also the radio play-by-play guy for Brooklyn Nets basketball. We're talking about FSHD, which he's battling right now. So is it impacting your work behind the mic? Because I know you said it can cause facial muscles to droop or whatever. Then obviously that could impact the way you speak, and that's important for you.
Yeah, and I think that I've battled through that. I'm on the radio. You know, sometimes you can be a little self-conscious about the way you look, especially if your facial muscles are affected.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of TV, and I think, thankfully, you're only on camera when you're doing play-by-play for a very limited amount of time. And it's probably all just in me being a little more self-conscious of it. But it doesn't affect. Maybe my lips get in the way a little bit, but only I notice that.
Okay.
I've tried to just be able to maintain. As you can see, I'm, speaking now. I'm able to get out the words pretty quickly and effectively, so thankfully, it hasn't affected me too much in the voice, but obviously, if you were watching me speak, you could see it in the lip muscles. So, that's all these things that you have to consider.
How do you and the family manage this?
Well, it was my wife Laura who really encouraged me to be out in public and talk about it and start the foundation. And I'm really fortunate enough. I think when you have this disease, you learn. It's kind of a litmus test of who's there for you. And my family has handled it with such, strength and grace and dignity. And I can't get through it without them. And sometimes it's I have trouble with the fact I feel like I'm a burden sometimes. And they always remind me that that's the furthest thing from the case. So. I'm really lucky in that regard.
Boy. All right, so I know there's no cure. What about managing the symptoms?
There's really nothing. I mean, you go to a doctor today, he tells you the same thing he told me 20 years ago, that there's no treatment, that there's no cure. You try and live as healthy a lifestyle as you can and try and ward off the effects as much as you can. But It's all kind of anecdotal. And I think what's really going to help people is the fact that they've identified a gene that causes this. They've identified a target for scientists to shoot for.
Okay.
And when I speak to scientists, they're hopeful that we could be in clinical trials in the coming years, you know, near future. There's a lot more pharmaceutical companies and venture capitalists that are getting involved in FSHD research. There were none when I started with this foundation in 2011. There's 22 now that have invested in the research. So it's kind of a hot commodity, and we hope that that will lead to further development, breakthroughs, cures. I mean, one of the targets right now that we're focusing on is clinical trial preparedness, trying to get biomarkers in the body so that when these companies do bring a drug to clinical trial, we'll be able to monitor the results effectively, and therefore, you know, people will want to get involved in trying to find the cure for this thing.
Man, I know that, boy, the fight for rare diseases is no easy task. But I know what, I'm going to see you next month because we've got an event in July. Set this up.
Oh, great. July 20th at Russo's on the Bay. We have a big dinner gala every year, well represented by Compass, who's a sponsor of the event every year. And it's just a great party in New York, in Queens, Howard Beach, New York. And I don't like these sad testimonials. If any of our fundraisers are upbeat, uplifting things that people just have a good time, party, dance, great food. And we raise a lot of money for FSHD research. And we're a volunteer organization. Everything that we bring in goes to research and to scientists to pay the salaries of postdocs who are working full-time on trying to cure this disease.
Mm, excellent. Hey, well, good luck, and see you next month. Much appreciated. Chris Carino. If you'd like to help out, read about it, donate, the website is fightforchris.com. What dad doesn't love to grill, especially when it's a great steak? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. And now this Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get a limited-time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter deal in the search bar. Omaha Steaks even offers online support with recipes and wine pairings. Here's the offer, 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes 2 tender mild filet mignons, 2 beefy top sirloins, 4 crispy chicken fried steaks, 4 juicy boneless pork chops, 4 all-beef Omaha Steak burgers, 4 gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all-beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. Only $49.99 at omahasteaks.com. Type deal in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type deal in the search bar, grab your dad, and fire up the grill. Thanks for being with us. You've spent all the time and all the money on that upcoming summer vacation with the family, but there may be one thing you've forgotten, you know, just in case. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
As you start making summer travel plans, here's something to consider: travel insurance. Consumer advocate Christopher Elliott has some advice on insurance and joins us now. Chris, why would we need insurance?
Well, travel insurance can protect your investment, your vacation investment. So it's a good idea to think about travel insurance if you're going somewhere. Now, not every trip needs to be insured, but there are some big ticket items like a cruise or a long tour, like, say, a couple of weeks in Europe, where you might want to think about getting an insurance policy.
Any idea about the price? Does it vary on the price of your trip?
There are two basic flavors of travel insurance. There's a named exclusion policy, usually 6 to 8% of the cost of your trip. And there's a cancel for any reason that allows you to cancel for any reason, as the policy says, and to get a percentage, usually 80 or 90% of the trip refunded. And that costs somewhere between 8 to 10% of your trip.
Chris, what kinds of things does travel insurance cover?
Again, it depends on the policy, and that varies widely. It varies by person even and by state, so you don't always get the same policy. But for the named exclusion policy, you have your luggage coverage on your luggage. You have, if you get sick, if you lose a job, terrorism, those are things that are covered normally. And sometimes it's, trip interruptions are covered. Natural disasters, man-made disasters, those can all be covered. Again, depends on the policy. For a cancel for any reason policy, you don't have to even give them a reason for why you're canceling. You can just say, I don't want to go, I don't feel like going, and you'll get a percentage of your vacation back.
Chris, it seems like travel agents in the past have pushed insurance for years and years, but people weren't really thinking about it or taking it. Has this changed?
Agents are still pushing insurance, sometimes for good reason, but sometimes not. Let me give you an example. If you're just going to visit grandma and you're driving there, and so you're not staying in a hotel, you're driving your own car, and you're visiting a national park, that's not the kind of vacation you're going to want to take insurance out for, because, you know, you're not spending any money necessarily. You're spending maybe money on gas. You're sleeping over at grandma's, so there's no hotel. And that's really, if you have an agent that's pushing insurance for that kind of trip, maybe you need a different travel agent. That's the kind of person who's just trying to make a little extra money. But as I said earlier, for trips that are of maybe $5,000-$7,000 value, a big ticket item, say you're going on safari, that's the kind of trip that you do want to consider taking insurance out for.
Do you hear complaints about insurance companies? Is it hard to get your money back? Do you have to fight them sometimes?
Sometimes you do. I do get quite a few complaints about travel insurance, and you have to really be careful when you're filing your claim. Make sure that you've dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with consumer advocate and travel expert Chris Elliott. 13 minutes now in front of the hour. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Thanks for being with us. Video game players join virtual teams, often with people they don't know, just like in real-life pickup games. Unlike the park or playground, though, online teammates hardly know anything about each other, not even real names. As Wall Street Journal tech reporter Sarah Needleman explains, when older and younger gamers join forces, things can get awkward. Sarah, what have you found?
Basically, when you play a mobile game, some mobile games you can join teams and play 3-on-3, 5-on-5, or you can join a guild. The preferred choice of communication, for the most part, is text messages. And that's because the game sessions are very brief, so they'll just have a quick text here and there, usually a group text. And it's just very difficult without the tone of voice to tell whether or not you're communicating with someone who's around the same age. And if not, some of your life's responsibilities, whether it be homework if you're a student or a job if you're a grown adult, get in the way of your gameplay, and it could cause a little bit of head scratching because the communication isn't necessarily, you know, straightforward. So you're kind of playing detective to figure out who it is and why they're acting the way they're acting.
Right. Yeah, it's a funny example. It's about adults being surprised that there was a kid on their team and vice versa, I guess. But what surprised me was the commitment. Like, some people get annoyed, right? If you're not there to support the team, if you have a job or you have homework.
Absolutely. I mean, these people take their gameplay very seriously. And just like with any sort of team activity, whether even if it's not a sport, even if at work, if you're on a team and one person's not pulling their weight, or one person is trying to take advantage of the other players, and it causes tension. And so some of the examples, there are students or young folks who are playing, and they ask their teammates to help them out, and suddenly they go offline because the teacher took away their phone or their parents took away their phone because they misbehaved, and the help that they had asked for from the other player went to waste, essentially, because when you go offline, that puts your, for example, your armies may be vulnerable, or your resources could be scooped up by other players. And so that's caused some tension between young and older players.
Well, we're speaking with Sarah Needleman, Wall Street Journal tech reporter. She's written a piece called Awkward Moments in Multiplayer Gaming. You're a sixth grader? So I presume, right, you can set age barriers if you're going to form your own team or group in these games.
And some of the teams, they just go by the honor system. I mean, they're not exactly able to screen people. I suppose they could ask you to send, maybe a copy of your birth certificate, I suppose. But nobody goes quite that far.
Could you imagine, like, being a grown man and you text a kid like, hey, how come you're not on the game right now? And the response happens to be, oh, my mom took away my phone. Reality check, right? 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. Move over cupcakes as school uniforms become more common from California to Maine. The Wall Street Journal says Jeans Day is becoming a fundraising powerhouse. The uniform policy, for example, at Florida's Imagine School at Broward is strict. Only khaki or navy bottoms with a school top. There is an exception, which comes on Fridays when students at the charter school get to break dress code as long as they pay up. To wear jeans at the school on Fridays, students must be members of the Jeans Day Club, which costs $25 per student or $35 per family to join. At Wingate Park Elementary in Charlotte, North Carolina, Jeans Day is the PTO's most consistent fundraising effort, pulling in several hundred dollars a month. Money's used to pay for things like school field trips. The popular fundraiser at Mount Calvary Lutheran School in Diamond Bar, California, is Jeans for Jesus. Students pay $1 a week to wear jeans on Friday. The money goes to help pay tuition for families in a financial bind. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. We appreciate you listening to This Weekend.